Okay, good evening. We are, basically still in the introduction stage of Megillas Esther, and I hope last week wasn't too off-putting. It's looking at it from a very different angle. But what I want to do, firstly, I want to say, in terms of introduction, sort of one or two more comments before we actually look at Perek Aleph. Good evening, which I hope we will do already this evening. Just to repeat very briefly what he said last week, we saw that the story, according to Rav Lau's estimation, and this is a very big discussion. I did a bit of research this week. A lot of the more secular writers are very perplexed about when this story took place. His suggestion is that it's in what he called the Chor HaShachor, the black hole, in between the time of Cyrus, Koresh, giving the orders of the to the Jews, allowing Am Yisrael to go and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, which they failed to take up the challenge and en masse. They started it, but then it stopped. And eventually it was continued, but only much later, 65 years later, with Ezra. Ezra came back with a group of Jews to Israel, and they finished the project. That's the way it's understood. So between these two time frames, it's the year 539 till the year that Ezra returned to Israel, 474, according to the non-Jewish calendar. During that period of time, the story of Purim took place. That's what we established last week with all the ramifications of what it means. One of the things that I think is important to also talk about, which we didn't get to last week, just sort of alluded to, some of the characters that we're going to have to deal with, particularly Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is translated in English as Xerxes, an impossible name to pronounce, two X's. And Xerxes, as much as Ahasuerus is considered to be a bit of a, you know, sort of, how should we say, a comic character, okay, a bit of a buffoon. The reality is, when we actually read the history of Xerxes, it's not quite the same sense of being a fool as Ahasuerus is presented. And one of the things that I want to show you already this evening from the first perek is something very, very significant in the life and the existence of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus, as we will see, and what I'm going to say for next week probably is the Malbim, who talks about the first perek in political terms, and it's an interesting discussion. But I would just want to talk generally about Perek Aleph. And Ahasuerus is, how should we say, his place in chapter 1 and really his whole mindset at this particular time. If we're going to accept that it is the same as Xerxes, as portrayed in history, then we are really dealing with a character who is very significant in the history of the world. This is a man who took the, how should we say, he took the challenge from his from the previous kings. And if we go back to Cyrus in the year 538, we're going to go through a king called Darius. We're going to go through a king, I think there's a number of Dariuses before we get to the Darius II, who is the son of Esther and Ahasuerus. That's going to be a bit later. But there are a number of kings that we will get through until we get to Ahasuerus, who's they estimate he came to the throne in the year 486. In fact, what I'll do, let me give you, this is, I'm dealing with timelines here, but I have to do this because otherwise you won't really know what's going on. You just hand out this. This is a bit of Wikipedia, which I don't usually like to give out, but occasionally it sort of helps us in terms of what we're dealing with. If you look at the bottom, this is timeline number two. Last week I wanted to show you just generally the how you get to this particular space of time in which the Purim story is suggested is happening. But the bottom here is just really a bit of Persian timeline. Okay, if you see at the bottom of the page, and then I'll just tell you what the rest of the page, I'm not going to read it now, but these are descriptions of the battles that Ahasuerus is preparing to have. At the bottom of the page you'll see 538, we're talking about Cyrus. 521, Darius is the first Darius, and there's going to be a whole bunch of them. 490, I didn't put on there, but that's the Battle of Marathon. And the Battle of Marathon was a very, very serious defeat. The first defeat for the Persian Empire. And 490, and it's not on your list, but 486 is the date when Ahasuerus takes over. So Ahasuerus essentially is happening after one of the major battles which took place between the Persian Empire and the Greek Empire, right? The Greeks, the Persian and the Greeks, the Battle of Marathon. And as a result of the Battle of Marathon, Ahasuerus has to regenerate or recoup all of the armies that have already been established under the rule of Persia for the next stage. Basically, what's happening is that between 538 and 486, there is a tremendous expansion of the Persian Empire. Okay, just to give you a bit of this kind of potted history here. Between 538 and 486, there's a tremendous, Darius particularly, the first Darius here that is referred to, this is, Rav Lau brings from Herodotus and various other writers who talk about the size of the empire, Mehodovat Kush. It's exactly the same as what we read in the Megillah, from India to Ethiopia. The empire was expanded to the extreme. And what Xerxes, Ahasuerus, is doing in 486 when he becomes the king of Persia is, number one, trying to even expand more than that, or at least to hold on to what he's got. All right, that's really what he's planning to do. And what happens between him and the year 483, we know in the third year of his reign, we are told about the parties, which we're going to read about today in Megillat Esther. We already are told by the historians that he had minor skirmishes. I don't know, instead of having a million on each side, there were a few hundred thousand on each side. Whatever it was, I don't know the numbers. But he's already put down rebellions from Egypt and in Babylon. He is already within the context of not just reestablishing, but trying to create a base for expansion. Okay, so that's basically where we're holding and when we start the Megillah. If you look at right in the middle of that timeline, 486, and you get to 483, which I've mentioned here, of the two parties, we're going to see that there were actually two celebrations that were going on, or two gatherings that were going on in Shushan, in the capital, then those 3 years were very significant in the time period of the beginning of the reign of Ahasuerus. So what we're going to say, very simply, in terms of the characters, Ahasuerus is going to be much less of a comic character, much more of a serious world figure in this, what Rav Lau calls the reality check, right? This is the expression that he uses, of looking at the Megillah from a historical perspective. And I just want to again say one more thing, is that we're very much used to looking at the Megillah from a Jewish perspective. Okay, and there's nothing wrong with that. And what I'm going to try and do is to show you that there are different lines or different perspectives through which we can view the Megillah. And if we do this, it's interesting because I don't find that it clashes very much. I find that it actually enhances. Each perspective seems to add a bit of an extra dimension to the other one. So if we're going to look at it historically, we won't be shy or move away from the traditional views. There will be differences. We already spoke last week about Mordechai and Esther, and there are definitely different views about who they were. But putting that to one side, the general idea will be to look at it like a tapestry. Okay, if you've ever seen sort of one of these complicated medieval tapestries, or you've been to I always think of the museum in Amsterdam, if you've ever been there, the Rijksmuseum, where they have these incredible paintings, the Rembrandts or whatever, and there's a lot going on in each painting, Bruegel, if you know what Bruegel is, and all those types of paintings, and the Megillah is like that. The Megillah, there is a tremendous amount going on, and what we are going to do is find all the different streams, all the different channels through which we can discover all of the themes in the Megillah. So one of the themes is obviously going to be the religious theme. The theme that we're looking at the moment is more of the historical theme. And there's also going to be a nationalistic theme as well. Okay, so all of this is going to have to come together, hopefully not too contradictory. Occasionally they will disagree on certain points. But in essence, it will come together to a crescendo at the end to show what this Megillah is really all about. I hope that point is understood. We are still following the historical theme at the moment. But by doing a bit of the Megillah itself, looking at Perek Aleph, we can integrate the historical theme into the traditional religious presentation that we have of the Megillah that we've done over the years that we've looked at, and many of us will have studied in the past. Looking at the page that I gave you, just to tell you what else is on the page, it talks about these battles. If you just go down to the timeline, after the two parties, which we're going to talk about in a minute, we've got in the year 482, which is 4 years after Ahasuerus comes to reign, we've got the Battle of Thermopylae. Thermopylae is very famous because that's the movie that they made, the 300, the story of the 300 Spartans who held off the Persians at a very narrow place. They were marching on Athens. They were trying to conquer it. And what happened at that battle is that there was a narrow pass which the 300 Spartan soldiers managed to keep the Persian Empire at bay. And the only way that they were defeated was that somebody ratted on them. One of their own ratted on them to the head of the Persian king, and basically told them another way to get round this particular bottleneck, and they eventually overran the 300 and killed them. So that's the Battle of Thermopylae in 482. You've got the battles of Salamis and Palatio, or whatever you pronounce it, in the year 480. These were actually sea battles as well as land battles. And in 479 BCE, we've got chapter 2 of the Megillah. It's very interesting. What essentially is going to happen between chapter 1, which we're going to read now, and chapter 2, there's a gap of 7 years. And it's as they say in Yiddish, oiskecheshbon, but it actually works out with the Megillah as well. Chapter 1 is actually taking place 3 years after Ahasuerus comes to power. If, again, on the timeline, the year 483. He's already, as we've said, he's had already necessity to fight certain battles himself in the early part of his reign. And he's now come to the third year of his reign, and he is now thinking about expanding the empire. If we see it like this, then chapter 1 is fascinating. And there is one ha'orah, one main thing that we're going to talk about this evening. I mentioned it last week, that in fact we've always considered the beginning of chapter 1 as being one long party, if you want to call it that. All right, the famous 180-day, half a year. And we always thought that that was, you know, a sign of frivolity, and the Ahasuerus is basically just living it up. He's a very hedonistic gentleman. And we have also mentions about 7 days in the palace where all the people came, and we blur the boundaries between these two gatherings. It turns out that if we take this in from a historical perspective, and it's happening after Xerxes, Ahasuerus, comes to power, he, in the third year of his reign, is actually doing something very smart. He knows that he has to go to war and to expand his kingdom, but he's got to bring all of the elements from the 127 countries which he's controlling into Shushan to basically bring them together to create an alliance. If they what he wants, you know, he needs an army, and they've all got to support him. So he's bringing them to the capital day after day for 180 days, all different types of people coming in order for him to, you know, I suppose you would call it building coalitions, right? I'll promise you if you promise me, I'll scratch your back, you'll scratch mine. You know, this sort of stuff. The stuff that goes on in Israeli politics the whole time. You know, this idea of bringing people together, making a coalition, and I suppose, you know, wheeling and dealing. And Ahasuerus is doing this. And this is what's happening in the Megillah in party number one. Let me show you what I mean. If you open up the Megillah, we'll start in chapter 1, verse 1, the famous Pesukim. Vayihi bimei Ahasuerus, in the days of Ahasuerus, who? Ahasuerus ha-molech mehodavad Kush. And of course, the author of the Megillah is pointing out that this is the Ahasuerus who was the Xerxes, who was the one in charge of the empire from India to Ethiopia. In other words, the largest expansion that the empire ever achieved. Presumably later on there were other Ahasueruses, as there were pharaohs in Egypt. It was like a generic name that they had. Okay, so this is one of the suggestions that is made there as well, in terms of what, why he sort of points out who Ahasuerus. But he says, at this point, the empire was expanded to 127 countries. This was enormous. And in order to achieve some sort of control, you had to have a massive civil service. You had to have people out there, governors and satraps or whatever they were called, all these types of names that we have in the Megillah. And look what it says in Pasuk Bet. In those days when he was sitting on the throne in Shushan, the capital, Bishnasholos the Molcha, in the third year of his reign, and when, again, historically what we understand is he's already had to, you know, fight certain small battles, but by this time, Asar Mishter, he makes a party, or a reception, let's call it, L'chol Sarav Avadam. Now, interesting, doesn't say L'chol Am, doesn't say for all the people in Shushan. This is not a party which everyone was invited to. You would call this nowadays, you know, sort of a reception in the White House, right? Where you have to have a special invitation to come there. It's Sarav, his princes, Vavadav, and his servants. And the suggestion, Rav Lau suggests, that who is coming to this particular gathering? All of the princes and all of the people in control who are spread out all through the kingdoms, right? You know, when you conquered a certain country, you have you put somebody in charge over there, but now you want to bring that particular influence, that particular group of people into your army. Because in order to go to the next stage of expansion, he's going to need a massive army. So what is he bringing? Chel Parasu Modai. He's bringing together the armies of Persia and Media, Partimim, Vesarea Medinos, the fun of. He's bringing the Partimim. It's always difficult to translate all these things. The princes of the provinces. What does it say? Sorry, the nobles, it says. All of these names have significance in the Persian Empire because they were referring to different controllers within the 127 countries who were, as it were, taken over by the Persians. All of these people, Soreya Medinos, the fun of, and all of the nobles of the countries came before him. And of course, what is he trying to do? He's basically got to do a bit of PR. He is trying to get a coalition together to expand the empire. He's he's got a dream of literally controlling the whole world. Gemara says this. He's one of the strongest, I've forgotten the exact expression, he was Tachata Kippah, I think the expression the Gemara said, that on the whole earth there were people who had these influences around the world, and Ahasuerus was one of the biggest. And basically, what does he do to impress the people who are coming to Shushan on a regular basis from all over the empire? Pasuk Dalet, Baharoto et Oshe Kavod Malchuto, Vet Yikar Tiferet Gedulato. He's showing them the riches of the kingdom and the splendor of his majesty. What is he trying to prove to them? Yomim Rabim Shmoni Matyam. What is he trying to show? If he's going to go on a massive war campaign, what does it take to do such a campaign? Not just people, but it takes
charisma and money.
He's got to prove that he can afford it. If he is getting an army together of those proportions, then one of the things that he's got to assure everybody is that he can actually sustain this type of expansion. He's showing them Osher Kavod Malchuto. He's showing them the riches of his kingdom, and everything that goes together with his greatness. And this is lasting 180 days. And of course, the famous comment of the Vilna Gaon, who says that, in fact, not only at this point was he showing them the general store, but he was showing them the temple, Kalim, the vessels of the temple, because according to his calculation, that 70 years, which we spoke about last year, was already gone by. And as far as he was concerned, the Jews were never going to go back to Eretz Israel, were never going to be redeemed, the promise was not fulfilled by God, and he had within his possession all of this incredible wealth. There is a fantastic midrash, and I only share this with you because it's so fantastic. It says that Nebuchadnezzar, when he conquered Yerushalayim, what did he do? He took all the wealth away from Jerusalem. All right, a bit like the second temple where the Arch of Titus, if you've seen it in Rome, it's got all the Romans carrying all the different vessels away from Jerusalem. There was always something to loot from the Jewish people, always. And what happened was that, this goes back to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was very, to put it very bluntly, very stingy. He did not want to give all of this wealth even to his own son. His own son was a guy called Ever Merodach. It's mentioned when we learn Sefer Daniel, we'll come across him a bit more. And basically, what did Nebuchadnezzar do? He decided to hide all his wealth. So what did he do? He made, it says he made boats out of copper. And in the copper boats, he put all of this wealth, and he flooded the boats, and they were under the surface of the Euphrates. Unbelievable story. And what happened was that when Koresh, many years later, overtook the Babylonian Empire, and the Persians were in control, what the reward that Koresh had for giving permission for Am Yisrael to build the Beit HaMikdash was that these boats came to the surface. There was like a nace. And he discovered the boats, and obviously they realized what was inside, and there was a wealth beyond belief. It's a whole midrash, and the Vilna Gaon brings this. And he says that what happened was that they found otzros, different amounts of treasure. It says 1,080 treasures. Whatever that, how that he gets to that number, I don't know. But he says what happened was it was 180 days and 1,080 treasures. He says every day six collections of treasure, six storehouses of treasure were being shown by Ahasuerus to the guests at this particular party. And what the idea was, and he gets the number six because of the description of what's coming up, all the different items, chur, karpas, techele, he says that each one refers to a different treasure. And he says there were, in fact, every day six treasures from the temple that were being shown by Ahasuerus to the people that were coming on a constant basis to Shushan. But what Rav Lau wants to suggest is that this is not a party where they are carousing, they're having a tremendous time eating and drinking. It's purely for diplomatic purposes. This is like what I suppose what you would call nowadays finger food party. All right, you know, they're just having the cucumber sandwiches with the crust cut off. Okay, a bit like the British system. I don't know, whatever they're eating. And they're having a bit of champagne or a bit of wine, but nothing serious. There's no suggestion that there is a tremendous amount of partying in the sort of traditional way we've understood it. This is purely to bring these people in, to impress them with his wealth, to impress them with his incredible riches, and to assure everybody that when they go out to battle in the next couple of years, he can sustain this particular war. Now look what happens in Pasuk Hei. Ubimalos ayomim ma'ela. At the end of these days, meaning after the 180 days, and note, during that 180 days, there's no reference to Mishta. Well, there is a reference to Mishta, but there's no reference to Shtiya in the traditional sense of what we're going to see now. What did it say? It said originally, it said, Asa Mishta. He made some sort of banquet, but it's not anything more than one word, and it's not exaggerated like it is in the next few psukim. Look at pasuk hey. B'melot ayom ma'ila, at the end of the 180 days, verse 5. Asa ha-melech l'chol ha'am. He decided, after succeeded in this diplomatic effort to bring everybody together, what does he do then? He decides that we're going to party for 7 days. Everybody in Shushan is invited to celebrate the successful effort that he had putting all of this army together. And at that point, who comes? Everybody in Shushan is given a chance to come in. It's like a free pass to enter into the palace. Migadol ad katan mishte shivat yomim b'chatzar ginat bitan ha-melech, and it's all happening in the garden of his orchard. In other words, this is like a real garden party, but with lots of food and lots of drinking, etc. Chur karpas u'techeles, and a description of all the different types of linens and cloths that were used. Achuz b'chav libutz ha-gaman. You can see all the translations. You've got it in front of you with linen and purple and kol galil kesa mudei sheish. Mitos Zav Echesev, they brought out all of the gold and silver couches or whatever they were. Rispa Bad Vashesh Tatava Sacharis. Impossible to translate. All the different marble. Everything was being shown. Vahashkos Bichle Zav. Vekelim Mikelim Shonim. Vayemachus Rav Kiyad HaMelech. That's when they opened up the how should we say, the wine cellars. That's when they brought out the real drink. Yeah. Yeah.
Because that was when Mordechai and Esther were living.
Yeah.
So normally it would have been some other.
It would have been somewhere else.
Some remote town somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
The capital should have been some exotic.
Something a bit more exotic.
But it wasn't.
Yeah.
And one of the miracles was that he created this capital in this small town of Shushan.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Mordechai and Esther.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I, you remind me of something. I when I worked in London, my first job before I sort of entered into this rabbinic gig, if you want to call it that, is I was working in a government office. I was doing some property valuation, in England it's called a surveyor, and there was a young lady who was working there, and she disappeared for a vacation for 2 weeks. She came back, this was in 1975, so it's 4 years before the revolution in Iran, and she came back with pictures of Susa. So I said, where is Susa? So she said, oh, this is Shushan, right, you know, in the Bible. So she actually visited there. The tombs of Mordechai and Esther are still there. Right, people go, you can actually go and daven. I mean, you wouldn't go now because you wouldn't want to go anywhere near the country. But the whole place is just amazing. There's a lot of archaeological digging that's gone on there, finding all of this, you know, what's being referred to here. And exactly what you're saying, that it was created by the king. In a sense, this makes perfect sense to us, because if we're saying that he's trying to impress and bring, what greater impression can you make than creating a Yeshmei, something out of nothing? All right, and he, of course, a lot of people argue, and Rav Lau mentions this, that no mention of God in the whole Megillah, but particularly here, because who is playing God at the moment? Ahasuerus. All right, so you can't mention God's name because he is playing God. We'll talk a bit more about the other traditional reasons for that, why God's name is not mentioned, except Melech and all the Rumozim. But it's so fascinating. And it's again, that's another theme, more what I would call the more religious theme that goes through the Megillah, but we've got to be aware of it, that there are circumstances coming together, different things that are sort of flowing into each other, which make this story particularly unique. And that's one of the amazing ones. Yeah, and we're going to come to that. What happened was, and this is what we're going to be saying by the time we get to the end of the first chapter, that between chapter 1 and chapter 2, and what's going on with Vashti, again, I'll leave that for the Malbim to give us a bit more detail, but we'll do that, Mitzvah Hashem, next week. But what basically happens by the end of Perek Aleph, he's ready to go to battle. Not only has he scored this incredible coalition from the outside, but he's become the absolute leader in the Persian Empire, got rid of his wife. And the reason why he had to get rid of her was, again, this is what Chazal tell us, that she was the Yichus, right? She was descended from Nebuchadnezzar. So he was the stable boy and she was the Yichus, and he married her to achieve what he wanted to achieve. And now we get to the point where she is belittling him in this whole story, and therefore, as a result, he's got to push her out. But of course, he is so, in a way, he's a man of decision, but he's depending on others to make the big decisions. That's one of his problems. That even though we see him as being this person, this world figure who's trying to conquer the world, when it comes to his own palace, he's got a lot of issues, internal struggles within the palace. So a lot of that is also going to become very clear, much clearer to us as we go along. Okay, between chapter 1 and chapter 2. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I wanted to show you this. I've never really seen it like this. That in fact, we're talking about two gatherings. One which was much more diplomatic and quieter. And then the second gathering, which was, you know, for want of a better word, they all let their hair down. And look what it says, Pasuk Zion, and we'll just read on a little bit. Vashkos b'klei zov, kelim b'kelim shonim. And of course, again, the suggestion that they were using different kelim from the temple. They were bringing them out. And of course, the wine was Kiyad HaMelech, as you know, he'd opened up his wine cellars and everybody could help themselves. And at this point, of course, the king, by allowing them to be almost, you know, without restriction, is again a sign of power. That as much as he can restrict them and create this coalition throughout the empire, when it comes to his own people, you know, he can snap his fingers 1 minute and they're under this rule of almost terror, because you know he can say you hang this guy and he's hanged. As we know later on, Haman is, you know, 1 minute he's there, next minute he's hanging from a tree. Ahasuerus does, he's judge and jury, so he's a scary guy. At the same time, he's also can let the people off the leash as and when necessary. And this again is part of what Ahasuerus is trying to prove to everybody, the kind of leader that he really is. Listen to this. Look at Pasuk Chet. We'll just read a few more Pasukim. Vashtia kadat eino nes. And now the drinking is really without being ones, they're not being forced. Right? In other words, they can drink as much as they want. Ki kein yisad hamele Al Korav Beitola Sokrason Ish Veish. That basically anyone can do in this particular circumstance whatever they want. So what has happened here is, in fact, there's been two parties. One party which we saw at the beginning, and then the second party now, which is the 7 days where everything is sort of, you know, let off the leash for 7 days. They can literally rejoice in what has happened and at the same time get ready for the inevitable, which is going to be the war of 14. At this point, just to go through the Pesukim a little bit more, Tet, Gam Vashti Amalka Astar Mishtei Nashim Beit HaMalchuta Shelem Echashverosh. She's making her own little gathering together for her people, and there's no suggestion that she was involved with the 180 days. It just says Beyom HaShvi, alright, so she's involved with party number two. So again, just to reinforce the point that there are two distinct gatherings that are happening here. The 180 days for purpose, which is a very different purpose to the 7 days, which seems to be much more frivolous and whatever image one has of the Persian court. This would be more in line with what we've studied till now. But I just wanted to make this absolutely clear that there are two distinct gatherings going on here. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, the first 6 months is supposed like more like in a conventions, because he gathered around him all the leaders of all the countries,
right,
like the Pshutei Aam. So if you want to impress them, you can't impress them just with the food and wine.
He's got to show them.
He has to get like really a plane, show his wealth. And next 7 days, it's Pshutei Aam. You
correct.
Give them wine, you give them food, they're happy.
Correct. And that's exactly what's going on here. And of course, in terms of Am Yisrael, the tradition is that they got involved with the second party, not with the first party. All right, and with the second party, this was when he's bringing out Kelim, Mikelim Shonim, which is Kelei Beit HaMikdash, and they're sitting there and they're not saying a thing, and they're accepting, and there's a whole suggestion that they were not eating kosher and everything else that was going on. It was, and drinking all this wine, etc. And of course, this was really something which became a very negative thing against the Jewish community in Persia at the time. And as I said last week, you know, we have to accept the fact that if we're dealing with the group of people that we are dealing with who did not go up to Eretz Israel but decided to stay Bululu, right? They stayed assimilated in the Galut, then this whole thing really makes a lot of sense. Sorry, you were going to say?
Say there was fundraising at the second party?
Was there fundraising, but not fundraising? No, I guess, you know, put the fun in fundraising. Whatever. I don't think, it doesn't suggest that there was. It doesn't suggest that there was, yeah. Yeah.
70 years. So, what are the other historians? If I'm going with Rabbi Lau's in charge.
Yeah.
What happened after the 70 years?
Yeah.
Shibastiyon was in 516.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But there's a problem. Once you actually start, for instance, looking at the dates of Ezra, there's a lot of missing years. There's a lot of problems with missing years.
If you go with Rabbi Lau, then the subjugation of Mondai, of Yoppa, on Mondai, right, Persia,
yeah,
continued.
Yeah.
Past 70 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's very, the whole issue of the actual timing and putting the Megillah story into that context is very difficult. That's why he's sticking his neck out by trying to sort of find this particular place. I think he's doing it not so much to be historically absolutely Yotze, because there are a lot of arguments about it, but I think he's trying to create the background of this particular, as I said, the tapestry which we are looking at from all the different threads of the tapestry, all the different types of presentation that we're having. And he's put the whole picture into this pre and post, before going back to Eretz Israel, and then after they started going back in real numbers. Yeah.
But isn't there one interpretation that he wouldn't dare take out the Kalim until after 70 years?
He said, aha. According to his calculation. And that's the Gemara. The Gemara plays with that, and tremendous calculations that go on in that whole discussion between him. His calculation was different to Belshazzar, the whole story over there. That's for Sefer Daniel. We'll Mitzvah Shem, we'll come to that when we get through this particular stuff. Yes. Yeah.
Amalka Vashti.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when she talks about herself, she calls herself first.
Correct.
Amalka, and then
That's another thread that I want to talk about. I wrote about that in the YU thing on last Purim, because there is a tremendous analysis to look at in terms of the use of the word Hamalka, all right, which I'm not going to talk about now. That's a whole nother discussion, how the word Hamalka is played around with, and particularly here, you know, the use of Hamelech. He's not just Melech, he becomes Hamelech. All right, where did we see that? We just read it, yeah, in Pasuk Chet. Shtia kadad in the kikain yisad Hamelech. All right, so he is not only just now the king, but he's the king. All right, because that's the impression that he wants to create, that in fact he is absolutely in control. And this is just the plot with Vashti, which we'll just read through very quickly. We all know this. Gam Vashti Hamalka. Now, of course, she is the Yichus, as we said. She is descended from the Babylonian kings. Asta Mishtei Nashim Beit HaMalchut Asher Mechashverosh. She has to have her own party. Bayom Hashvi Ketov Lev Melech Bayayin. And when he is very much inebriated, Omar Lemehuman Bizach Havona Bigzach Vaksa Zesav Karkas Shivas Asarisim Amshos Pnei Mechashverosh. He has these seven counselors who are very close to him. Some say Mahuman is the same guy as Haman, all right, but that's already sort of a drosh, as it's not absolutely clear if that's the case, but there is a suggestion. Yudalev, Lahavi ad Vashti ham malka lifnei ham mele beketa malchut. So they want to bring Vashti into the party, wearing her crown, and the rabbis say, and nothing else. Laharos amin vasarim yofyo ki tovas marehi, to show off her beauty. Now, of course, what we're going to suggest, and we'll see the Malbim suggest this, that this is not a wonderful thing to do. On the contrary, he's trying to belittle her. He's trying to belittle her. And of course, the rabbis make up a tremendous midrash on this, that she grew a tail, and she wasn't very excited being seen in public with a, unfortunately, an appendage, which she wasn't so excited about. And of course, you'd bet, but to mine, Hamalka Vashti. She sends back the message, you know, who's the boss around here? I am, right? Lovo, so she refuses. Lovo b'davar melech, asher b'yad asari sim. And of course, what happens is that his anger goes very, very extreme. And of course, he has this conversation with his advisors what to do. And this is part of the Achashverosh analysis that we have to come to terms with, that as strong, again, the contrast, as much as he is this incredible person on the outside in terms of conquering the world, in his own kingdom he is very in Hebrew it's called hofech. He's going from one extreme to the other, right? He's again, they create a kind of caricature of this guy, but it's more about the inability, or his inability to be in control, even though he thinks he is in control. In the end, of course, the message, the religious message, is that in fact it's God in control and not him. And this is something that he has to come to terms with, or he will be made to come to terms with during the course of the story. So what happens, Yudalev, again, I'm just going to finish this chapter and we'll just look at the timeline to finish the point today. This is verse 14. These are the guys who sit at the front. So they have to have a cabinet meeting. What are we going to do with about the queen? She refuses to come. She refuses to comply. He expands the whole thing into a much bigger sin. It's not just against the king. Everybody's going to be in trouble. And remember, Achashverosh, going back to what we said at the beginning, is trying to impress, had tried to impress everybody in the kingdom that you know, his word was absolute. And now, the first sign of trouble with Vashti, and of course it undermines his power. And it will become kind of, you know, something in the whole kingdom that the women will stand up and start abusing their husbands, literally. But Amram, Amelech Hashverosh, Amar. And they'll repeat the story that the king tried to bring Vashti Amalka lefano velo ba, and she didn't come. Vayomazet tamanasaros parasamadai sheshomu et devar Amalka choser Amelech uktaibiz and ketzer, and everyone will hear about it, and it's a busha, it's a shanda. What are we going to do? And now we understand that this again is all part of the mechanics of the Megillah, because so many people are questioning, why do we really need to be told this whole chapter one, this whole story? If it's about the story of the Jews being under pressure to in the Persian capital and the Persian Empire, that their lives are being attacked, this whole first parak doesn't seem to be necessary, right? To talk about the politics of the king's palace. But of course it is necessary, because we see that the king is now someone who, you know, gains absolute power, and by gaining absolute power, he of course can later on exercise absolute power against Haman, turning the decree against the Jews, turning it around, allowing the Jews to fight for their lives and in fact to kill their enemies. All of this is significant, and it all comes from Perek Aleph. So just to finish the Perek, Yud Tet. Turn it into an absolute law. It's like, you know, we say in the Torah, it's something that it's almost like a cardinal principle here. Firstly, everybody should know that she refused to come. And the kingdom will be given to somebody else. Even though it seems to be a sort of minor benefit that, you know, that the husbands will become respected by the wives again, but of course it's much more about the power of the leader to be able to initiate, to say, and it's, you know, his power is absolute. And he followed what he was told, and he did it. And the final possible, sent it in all different languages, because he wants, again, if he's building the confidence of all of the countries under his rule, he has to send this out in every language. He has to make sure everybody gets it. Lios kol ish sareba beiso medabek l'shan amo, that everybody is, this decree is made, even though it seems to be a very, almost a peripheral thing, but it is just one example of Achashverosh showing his absolute ability to control. That, again, I'm sorry I've rushed through chapter one. As I said, next week maybe we'll look at it in a bit more detail. But I just wanted to make this point. Between Perek Aleph and now, Achar Devarim Ha'Eileh, the beginning of chapter two, there is a gap. And everybody recognizes it. It's a 7-year gap. And the question is, what has happened from the end of chapter one to the beginning of chapter two? This is fascinating. And if you go back to the page that I gave you at the beginning, and you'll see at the bottom, go back to the middle of that line, Xerxes, Achashverosh, takes over in the year 486. 483, we saw that we just had these two parties, right? Party number one, which was to bring all the people together from all the different countries to show the wealth, etc., and basically to build an army together, which is going to take out and try and conquer the world. We now go in back from the Megillah back into history. Now, the Megillah doesn't mention any of these battles, because it's not what the Megillah is about. The Megillah is more concerned, much more concerned, only concerned essentially with the intrigue within the palace and the Yad Hashem, etc. As we said before, the religious angle is paramount. But if you look at the historical angle, it embellishes the whole story. Look at this. You've got the year 482, the Battle of Thermopylae, where in the end, Achashverosh's army is not absolutely successful. You've got the battles of Salamis and Palatium 480, all right, where in fact he is defeated. According to the Greek tradition over here, I think he actually mentions this. The Battle of Salamis. See the last three lines, last four lines in the English in this Wikipedia thing. The Battle of Salamis, September 480 BC, was won by the Greek fleet. After which Xerxes set up a winter camp in Thessaly, all right, wherever that is. Due to unrest in Babylon, Xerxes was forced to send his army home to prevent a revolt. So things are beginning to fall apart. Leaving behind an army in Greece under Mardonius, who was defeated the following year in Palatia. So what is going on here is that the grandiose scheme of Achashverosh, of Xerxes, to conquer the world is basically, how should we say, it's kaput. It's gone. He's not succeeding. On the contrary, he probably, you know, he sort of took on too much, too quickly, whatever way you want to understand it. And by the year, the end of that line, 479, he is coming back with his, literally, his tail between his legs. He's coming back to Shushan. And he is in how should we say, not in crisis mode, but he's changing his approach. He's now not looking to conquer the world. He's looking at least to make sure that his own kingdom is established and at least is functioning. And that, of course, is the beginning of Perek Bet of chapter 2. Because chapter 2 is where he's focused from, taken away from the outside, the 127 kingdoms, and he's now looking at the kingdom within, trying to find a wife, trying to find, you know, sort of build within, and to at least be in control, he hopes, to be in control of his home territory. It's fascinating. Yeah.
So he's saying the 7-year difference between chapter 1 and chapter 2, which is according to the 7 years, and the first pasuk of chapter 2 was now his anger subsided. He was preoccupied with war for 7 years before.
That's what it's suggesting, yeah, that there was, in fact, a sense of him having to go out to battle where does it start here? It starts from 483 and it goes through to 479. That's only 4 years.
It's 4 years.
We're talking about 7 years because of 486.
486.
Yeah, that's the thing. And what happens is, so this is essentially 4 years after the first battle of 483. 3 years, in other words, he's 3 years in control. Has these two parties, he then goes out to battle for 4 years, so it's now 7 years from the beginning of his reign till chapter 2. That's the 7 years. Yeah, sorry.
There's got to be many interpretations as to the first pasuk. It could have been written by Yibi Mei Achashverosh, Hamolech Mei Hodu Akush.
Yeah.
But that who Achashverosh, there's got to be.
Yeah, we suggested that there were many Achashveroshes. This was like a generic name. So it's pointing out that the one that we're talking about is the one who not only consolidated the empire, but wanted to expand it. And this is the one. This is the guy. Who Achashverosh. Yeah.
Can't you say that now, from this point off from chapter 2-1, he's doing his fundraising because he's lost the war?
He's certainly trying to consolidate because he realizes now he can't expand.
He's lost money also.
And he must have lost a fortune. According to, he doesn't bring it here, but Rav Lau brings this, that he came back to Persia with 43,000 soldiers out of hundreds of thousands. So the guys were killed. Who knows? It was a financial disaster as well as being, in war terms, it was a complete disaster. So he's now got to backtrack. And of course, his kingdom in the meantime has been hefka, because he's been away for this period of time. And there's been no queen. So that now becomes priority to establish at least within the kingdom some stability so that, you know, he's not going to lose it all. Because he is in the process of literally throwing it all away. Unbelievable. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if Vashti stayed in force for another 7 years until he came back.
No, it seems to be that was already done away with at that party after 3 years of his leadership. You know, part of what he was doing was creating this enormous sense of control, at least as far as he was concerned, and part of that was to get rid of Vashti. We're going to talk about that next week because the Malbim goes into great detail about that. And I think it actually fits very nicely into this more historical approach to see what Malbim says linguistically, the Fi Alashon, to understand that this is all happening as part of Achashverosh's attempt to become the Gibor, the Chazak. And it's so interesting. Just to repeat again what we've said, to put it very bluntly, is that, and this to me was again a massive chiddush, is that in fact we're looking at two parties in the beginning of the Book of Esther, both of which are significant but for different reasons. This is not just one complete binge from beginning to end. What is happening is that the 180 days we said was Achashverosh's attempt to bring all of the different elements from the kingdom together in order to achieve some sort of unity. On top of that, you've got, and that's a more diplomatic, and therefore there will be 180 days of very, very serious diplomacy going on day and night, more or less, for that period of time. Probably should be going on in Washington at the moment, but who knows. And at the end of that period of time, you've got chapter 1 bringing us a second party, which is where they actually kind of celebrated the fact, at least Achashverosh would have celebrated with the people, the fact that, you know, he's achieved this coalition, and he's allowing them a week of hefkeres, literally of letting go of all the rules. At the end of that, as we saw, he goes out to battle. He has a tremendously negative experience all the way through till he get to the battles in 480 and 479. That's the beginning of Perek Bet when he comes back And it's, I suppose, the Megillah not wanting to refer to the battles, but presents it as a continuous effort from chapter 1, but historically there is a gap. And at this point, of course, the king is saying to himself, or being told by the servants, you know, we've got to find a new queen. We've got to find, because if you want to reestablish your stability, at least at home, you've got to have a queen with you. All right? Without the queen, it's not going to happen. Until William got married, it wasn't happening. Now, you know, they're all looking, getting at least for till he's 90 years old when he'll become the king of England. Who knows? But he's found his queen. So what we're going to see, Mezzeh Shem, next week is two things. Number one, we're going to talk a little bit more about what Ahasuerus is achieving in chapter 1, and then move on to Perek Bet, where we're going to start looking more at the internal circumstance, right? I hope I've sort of haven't over. I hope it hasn't been sort of too heavy looking at the more historical thing, but I think that's fascinating. Put it in that context, and then Mitzvah Shem, we'll see in chapter 2 a bit more about Mordechai and Esther, what they're all about, not only from the historical perspective that we're using at the moment, but also obviously from the more religious and national perspective that we understand them. I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much. Thank you. Have a good evening.